Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams podcast. Joining me today is Sam Burns of Mill Street Research. Sam and I have been trying to get this conversation down for quite some time now, and my travel schedule has meant several cancellations and postponements, but we finally managed to find a time where we could both sit and talk to that. So without further ado, here is my much-delayed conversation with Sam Burns. Sam, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad we finally got to do this. My apologies for all the scheduling snafus, but we're finally here. Welcome.
Oh, no, thanks for having me on, Grant. It's a pleasure to be here.
So listen, before we get into what we're going to talk about today, how about you give the folks listening a quick introduction to you, your background, and what you're doing now at Mill Street?
So I've always been sort of a quantitatively oriented, you know, macro market strategist at various places and doing various things over the years. I started Mill Street about 7 years ago as an independent research provider, and kind of took the best of the best of all the things that I've done and built and learned over the years, you know, whether it's back at Ned Davis Research, where I worked down in Florida for a while, or State Street Global Markets, or Brown Brothers Harriman, or Oppenheimer. I've kind of put them all together into one place and, you know, have full control over everything and have no no conflicts of interest, essentially, or anyone telling me what to do, which of course means that, you know, right or wrong, it's all my views, but it does let me take all the tools and indicators and models and things that I've built and relied on for a long time and offer them to clients directly, which has been good. That's really what my background is trying to find, you know, objective process-driven tools that I can use to kind of frame, you know, how I look at the markets. And then, of course, the trick is always knowing, you know, what the rules are and then when to break them, that some things can't be modeled. Some things are just, you know, events that happen and you have to figure out how to deal with them. And so that's what some of the commentary and things I do tries to get at. But it certainly keeps it interesting, always something to talk about. But yeah, always a kind of that set of data and indicators that I've tested over the years to rely on to look at first.
Terrific. That's quite a pedigree. I've never met anybody that came out of Ned Davis that wasn't incredibly smart and really, really fun to talk to. So I look forward to having a talk with you. And you know, your latest macro view is where I want to start, actually, because the speed, as you pointed out, we've gone from heavily oversold markets to heavily overbought markets, you know, in the space of a month is absolutely shocking, frankly, considering how kind of black everything was a month or so ago. So let's start with that. Let's start with that broad macro view, that massive swing from oversold to overbought. And I'll just let you talk about that as you wrote about it, and then we'll kind of dig into the details.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's pretty shocking. You rarely see that dramatic of a move, you know, in that space of time. I think what's made it more dramatic is the fact that stock prices and bond prices are positively correlated now over the last 6 months, certainly much more so than they've been for, you know, at least 10 or 20 years. You've got, you know, one kind of pulling the other at the same time, as opposed to their usual kind of negative correlation, where if you're risk on, you buy stocks and sell bonds and vice versa. Whereas now it's people buying bonds and stocks at the same time, and which, you know, really kind of tells you that it's interest rates and bond yields that have been the thing that have been driving stock prices or keeping them from going up for the last, you know, since at least July, at least. And that once that pressure resolved, or at least, you know, came off some, that allowed stocks to rally, but it meant bonds needed to rally too. And so you've had bonds being unusually volatile for the last year, 18 months, whatever it's been. You look at the volatility of long-term bonds and they've been extremely high. Stock volatility has come down over the last year and is fairly moderate, but it's still correlated with bonds. And so I think you've got those two things now accelerating each other as opposed to opposing each other. And that's what's made it a lot more dramatic, which tells you kind of how the influence of inflation and the Fed have been, you know, the bigger drivers more so than earnings, for instance, or the economy, which has been better than expected and generally pretty good, but, you know, relatively stable recently. So that's been, it's been the rate side of things rather than the growth side of things that has been driving things. And that's what you're seeing in markets now. So it's pretty unusual. And I think it's thrown a lot of people's models and other things off balance because they're not used to stocks and bonds moving like this together.
So, can we sound the all clear? Can we hang the mission accomplished banner on the deck of the aircraft carrier? Because it feels to me a little premature, but that's something that people are desperate to believe in, particularly when you kind of line it up with the traditional Santa rally. Everyone's foaming at the mouth again. Is it safe, do you think?
Well, yeah, it's funny. Now that we've had this big rally and you've seen sentiment really turn back up again, both in the surveys and the VIX and everything else, my guess is that we might need some consolidation here, at least for a little while, work down these gains. Not that stocks are going to go down a lot, just that, you know, you've had the good news on interest rates and inflation, basically, you got in November. The Fed has now essentially more or less decided that it's off the table in the sense of no more rate hikes, and you may get some rate cuts next year. And so the good news for bonds, or at least interest rates for now, is probably in. And so it may be harder to get incrementally good or upside surprises, I would say. And that's kind of where I'm at now, in the sense that I was much more bullish on equities earlier this year because it looked like people were too negative and there was room for upside surprises. Now it looks like kind of sentiment has caught up. People's expectations are higher. They're not crazy high, but they're higher. And therefore, it's harder to come in better than expectations, both from the economic standpoint and an earnings standpoint, than it was earlier in the year. So you may get it more kind of choppy, range bound. You know, it grinds higher maybe, but not the moonshot that we might, you know, otherwise expect. And so, yeah, seasonality is good now. And I say the Fed is probably, you know, kind of less of an influence now. Their messaging has been pretty clear that they're going to step back and wait and see. And then maybe as reported inflation comes down, real rates will look higher and they'll be able to trim rates sometime next year. And, you know, ideally we'd get something like 1995, which, as you may remember, you know, was kind of the soft landing scenario where the Fed was able to cut rates a few times without a recession or a crisis or a banking problem or whatever. And that was, you know, very good for stock markets.
I'm curious, let's stick on this Fed for a minute, because this idea that they're talking about, you know, potentially being able to cut rates in 2024 at some point, you know, I find interesting, because that tells me that this dynamic we've created where the markets are dependent upon rate cuts and liquidity and cheap money is something that's understood by the Fed. You know, they're dangling that carrot, like, don't worry, we'll be able to cut rates. It shouldn't be something that they telegraph in advance. It should be a reaction to conditions. It should be a tool they use to kind of mitigate problems in the future. It shouldn't be a carrot that they dangle in front of the markets to kind of keep everybody calm. I'm curious as to what you think about that, because that is a definite change for me in terms of how they've used forward guidance.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, they definitely have tried to evolve how they do guidance, you know, over the years. And I think, you know, part of it was the fact that the COVID shock and everything that came after that was so dramatic and so extreme. And they weren't used to that. None of us were, but I mean, they weren't used to that either. And so they kind of got a little bit behind the curve coming out of it. And also, I think the fact that they understand what's going on in terms of inflation dynamics, which is basically we had a big jump in inflation, which is essentially a one-time shift in the price level, which kind of was late 2021 into 2022, and then has basically ended. And now, you know, the reported inflation data are coming back down, but slowly, because there's lags in the data and things like that. And they can't respond to by lowering rates or adjusting their policy until they kind of see the reported inflation data come all the way back down again as a public perception thing. They can't declare victory on inflation until, you know, CPI is down around 2% or something like that. Not because it's not going to get there, but because the public perception requires them to sort of kind of play this game. So in my mind, inflation isn't a problem, hasn't been a problem for quite a while now in the US, and will be coming down globally as well. And that too little growth is going to be the risk next year, not too much. I think they kind of realize that, but they're kind of stuck a little bit. They can't admit that publicly just yet. Now, what I see as kind of the difference this cycle for the Fed and for the rest of us is that fiscal policy has been much, much stronger than it has been historically. And you've kind of had the two waves. You had the COVID wave with all the stimulus checks and everything else. And then that kind of went away. And everyone assumed once that went away, the economy would go into recession and, you know, the Fed would be tightening and you'd have fiscal policy going much tighter, and that would cause recession like it has in the past. But you had the kind of second wave of the Infrastructure Act, the CHIPS Act, the you know, Inflation Reduction Act, all those things that came along kind of late 22 and into this year, and that we're now feeling the effects of, that are much more infrastructure and construction, manufacturing, building out, you know, supply and productive capacity, rather than just handing out checks to people or tax cuts and things. And so I think that's why the U.S. economy has done better than expected this year, and why the U.S. economy has done better than the rest of the world. And I think that's what the Fed is now having to kind of angle against a little bit, in the sense that they think that real rates and their policy has to be tighter to offset some of the fiscal policy that we're seeing now, which we have not seen for decades, really, in this fashion. And that's the question they're kind of facing right now, is how much their rates have to adjust to what they're saying in fiscal policy. And I think that's been the real swing factor this year. We've seen it in earnings estimates that I look at for industrials and building-related companies and housing, but you've also seen it in the macro data.
Let's stick with that for a second, because this idea that inflation isn't a problem, and the idea that monetary policy is sufficiently restrictive, you know, I would take issue with both of those, just in the general market sense, because based on what's happening in risk assets, based on what we're seeing in speculative assets, there's no way monetary policy is sufficiently tight. And the idea that they would telegraph, you know, maybe 6 months in advance that we're going to bring rates down when rates are at 5%, they're not at 15%. You know, 5% is a very sensible cost of capital. And, you know, treasury bonds are trading within cooey of where they were back in 2007 before the financial crisis. And also the idea that inflation, yes, while the CPI increases are moderating, you know, the price levels, and I've been traveling a lot these last couple of months. You know, I've been in Europe, I've been in the US, I've been in the Cayman Islands, I've been in Canada, and I'm shocked at how expensive everything is. I mean, genuinely shocked. And it's not that things have suddenly gotten expensive, but they've taken a leap. Just the average cost of existing, not even, you know, going out to fancy restaurants or anything, is markedly higher. And so I'm curious, on a consumer level, whether this narrative about inflation is no longer a problem is going to fly, particularly in an election year. I wonder what you think about that.
Well, no, you're absolutely right, in the sense of perceptions among consumers and kind of the average person seeing what prices are doing is very dramatic right now. You see that all over the place now. Partly it's people reacting to a change in the price level versus the rate of inflation, the kind of the rate of growth of inflation. That's what's, you know, come down. And so when you say inflation's come down, yes, that's true, it has, but that doesn't mean the price level, things are not going back to the price they were in 2019, and almost certainly will never do that. That's almost never happens. And in fact, if they did, then that would require a global recession, you know, a depression level event to push prices down 20% or whatever it was that they've gone up. So you had basically, like, say, a big one-time kind of shift in the price level caused by COVID and all the responses to it, which will not fully reverse. So the best we can really hope for is that the inflation rate continues to come down. I think it kind of already has in many ways in the U.S. And so their prices aren't really going up very much now on a rate of change basis, but they're not going to go back down on a level basis. And the fact that it happens quite dramatically kind of all at once within a year, 18 months or whatever it was, has kind of been a shock to people, because we haven't had that in decades. You know, for a long time, the Fed was trying to get inflation to go up and they couldn't do it. And I think a lot of it is that the Fed does not control inflation or influence inflation as much as people think it does. I think fiscal policy, and whether it's taxes, spending, regulation, all those things, and global influences, particularly China, have a much bigger influence on inflation than whatever the Fed funds rate is. The Fed's fund rate definitely affects certain things like housing and autos in terms of the cost of capital and cost of borrowing. But of course, a lot of people who own, you know, bonds or money market funds, whatever, are earning a lot more income now. They're getting a 5% rate instead of a 0 or 1% rate. And so all that income, now it's going to different people in different places. So it's an allocation issue, but it's still creating money to be spent in the economy. And so I think there's a lot of kind of offsets. If the price of money goes up, it's bad for borrowers and good for savers. When it goes down, it's the other way around. So it's always a relative trade-off, not a unilateral move in one direction. So I think people have over-focused on the Fed and under-focused on fiscal policy. And that's true in the U.S. and globally. Europe has not had the coordinated fiscal policy that the U.S. has, and they're suffering for it, essentially. China used to do that, have big coordinated fiscal moves, and now they kind of run out of capacity to do that anymore. It doesn't look like they're really going to have the ability to drive global growth the way they did, even in, say, in 2015, 16, or other times when they've really been the kind of a big driver of demand. And so, and the rest of the world, I mean, it just isn't big enough to do it all in a coordinated way. So I think that's been the difference here. I think, yeah, you're right, from a public perception standpoint, people see prices as high and not going down, except for a few things here and there. That's the perception. In terms of politics and in terms of, you know, consumer surveys and things like that. The Fed, of course, is looking at the inflation rate. And so are those of us, you know, kind of on Wall Street or things looking at economic policy. And so a 5 or 5.5% policy rate, if inflation is at 2%, is quite tight. That's high. I mean, that's about as high as it's ever gets. And assumes if real rates are supposed to be roughly in the kind of the growth rate of the real economy, that assumes that the real economy is growing at a 3% rate or something, which it probably isn't. And so that's probably a little too tight. You could have real rates at, you know, 1 or 2% and be not very accommodative still, but have, you know, somewhat lower rates than you have now. And so I think that's where the Fed is maybe thinking about going and where the market is thinking about. It's not what the average person or consumer is thinking about. And certainly seeing an 8% mortgage rate now compared to 3.5%, you know, 2 years ago is, again, it's a big shock for anybody trying to do anything with housing or commercial real estate. And so I think there's a big perception gap there.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I'm curious, as we go into an election year, the Fed has been very focused on communication with market participants. They've been very keen to make sure that they get their messaging right, forward guidance, but it's all been aimed at financial market participants. They've been trying to stimulate, you know, animal spirits in markets. They've been trying to calm animal spirits in times of trouble. But as we go into an election year with prices this high, it feels to me like the Fed's job is going to shift to try and talk to consumers, because they need to kind of start messaging the people who are going to vote next year. And I think the Fed is both apolitical and completely political at the same time, i.e. whichever party's in power, they are going to be extremely political in a year leading up to an election, just for stability's sake, if nothing else. Do you think that's true? Do you think that the Fed is either starting to lean towards how do we message away from Wall Street and towards the consuming public? Or do you think that it's just business as usual and they're going to continue to tweak all their messaging to try and placate market participants?
Yeah, in terms of messaging from the Fed, I still think the biggest thing that they have to come out and talk about and testify to Congress about is inflation. And so they're going to keep pointing to the CPI or the PCE or whatever it is, and as well as the unemployment rate. I mean, those are their two main objectives, inflation and employment. And if they can say inflation is around 2% and unemployment is low, then by sort of official standpoint, they've done their job, or at least they can sort of claim some sort of victory in terms of what their goals are officially. So I think if they can see the progress in inflation, which I think we will, you know, going into next year, then they'll be able to claim a bit of victory there and say, okay, well, you know, we tightened aggressively, inflation came down, job well done. We can back off a little bit and give some relief to, you know, homeowners trying to buy a, you know, house and maybe get mortgage rates to come down a bit, or people trying to buy cars. And now that car prices are starting to back off some. So I think the things that are most sensitive to what the Fed is doing, housing and autos predominantly, are where people are going to respond, whether it's politics or just the average consumer, if they are able to back off a little bit and say that, you know, yeah, inflation rate has come back down again. And so we can offer a bit of relief to those who are trying to borrow money to buy expensive assets like housing and cars. But I think in terms of, you know, the politics, they want to preserve their kind of, you know, independence on their view. But their main thing is to say, yes, we, you know, we got inflation down and we got unemployment down, even if in reality they didn't, or that, I mean, they were only marginally responsible for it. Inflation was going to come down anyway once supply chains healed. And fiscal policy is really the bigger factor, I think, in the overall economic growth and employment. So the Fed has kind of responded as they typically would, but man, it has not, I wouldn't say, been responsible. I think their messaging to Wall Street has been fairly typical in the sense that they don't want assets to run off too far, too fast, but want to keep things stable. They're also, of course, looking at bank balance sheets, which have been were a big problem earlier this year, and all the big losses that they had on the bond holdings that they had from a year or two ago, which brought down Silicon Valley and all those other banks. And of course, the reason that they had the big bond losses was the Fed raised rates really fast. So I think there's some of that. And even just the rally in bonds in the last month or so has helped the banks that are sitting on basically leveraged bond portfolios. They now have smaller losses or some gains there. And that's why a lot of the banks are rallying and their earnings estimates are improving. So the Fed has always got one eye on the banking system and the fact that there's a lot of those unrealized losses on bonds on their balance sheets. And if they can cut rates a little bit or at least stop raising them, that helps those kind of wobbly banks, their mid and small cap banks that they've been struggling with all year. So I think there's both a regulatory kind of side and then the public perception side that they're trying to balance.
You mentioned earnings there. Let's talk about earnings for a minute, because there's been a lot of talk about earnings forecasts, earnings estimates. They looked extremely hopeful earlier in the year. And in the conference calls and stuff that I've listened to and the transcripts I've read, I see an awful lot of talk from CEOs and CFOs that would give me cause to worry about earnings. But that hasn't seemed to affect the market, hasn't seemed to affect forecasts. Give us a snapshot of your thinking around S&P earnings.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, earnings estimates have been relatively stable, including for the 2024 estimates that we track for the index. And that's actually unusual because normally analysts start off with quite optimistic views on kind of the longer term, a year or two out earnings forecast for companies. And then as time approaches, they adjust reality and bring their numbers down a bit. So it's a start high and kind of trim is the general pattern that analysts follow. And this, so far at least, the estimates for 2024 have not followed that pattern. They've actually kind of held steady, which is sort of better than expected. I mean, you'd expect the numbers to be going down for the year out, and they haven't. And I think that's, you know, again, they came into 2023 much too sort of negative and cautious. And that was true for analysts, but also for investors. Most people were expecting earnings and the economy to be much weaker this year than it turned out they were. And so certainly after the first quarter earnings came out around April, and then the second quarter earnings came out around, you know, July, there were big upside surprises. They were much more positive and the guidance was much more bullish than analysts had expected. And you saw analysts raise estimates. They had to come in and revise higher. Third quarter earnings have been kind of much more mixed. The earnings themselves were fine, but the guidance was, you know, like you said, kind of mixed. You know, they're starting to feel the effect of higher rates, and analysts have already kind of adjusted their earnings up some. So again, it's harder to beat expectations and you know, kind of beat and raise if you've already had the raises to some degree. And so I think it's been an adjustment in sentiment and kind of forecasting to make it harder to beat or to call for further increases in earnings, but not necessarily the earnings are going to fall apart. They'll be stable. They'll be okay. There'll be some kind of rotation amongst which types of companies are doing better or worse. And that's what I've been focusing on more, is kind of that, you know, rotation and who's doing well and who's not. But yeah, the overall pattern has been to sort of slow the pace of positive news, but not really get into broadly negative news. And you've definitely seen that, for instance, the large caps have been much stronger in terms of their earnings than smaller caps have. And that's still the case, but the gap has narrowed a bit. Large caps have kind of slowed down a bit and small caps have been stable. And that's, I think, telling you that the influence of interest rates has hit the small cap companies harder than it has large caps. Most large caps don't need to borrow as much as the small companies do. So they haven't been hit as hard. As interest rates become less of a factor, that'll probably normalize a bit. And you'll see that kind of gap narrow a little bit. So I'm kind of looking to see if companies or sectors, industries that are less influenced by rates or that can benefit from higher rates, like some of the financials, are the ones that are kind of showing up more at the top of my list. And then other areas that are either rate dependent, like utilities or real estate, and don't have growth drivers, or things like commodities, energy materials, which just have secular pressures, headwinds against them, are the ones where you're seeing things kind of roll over more.
What about the high levels of bankruptcies we're seeing? Because we're seeing this kind of, again, this kind of split data set coming in. We are seeing, as you say, the earnings revisions, which are actually okay. They're starting to tail off a little bit now. But we are seeing extremely high levels of bankruptcies. We are seeing a lot of defaults in the commercial real estate sector. You know, we've got this kind of two-speed market going on, and it's not just 30 miles an hour and 15 miles an hour. It's full speed ahead and reverse. How do you bring all that together and try and make sense of it and focus on which of those is the more prevalent? Because the market's become used to focusing on positive news and ignoring the negative news because they've always kind of had the Fed at their backs should things get wobbly. Is it still the smart thing to do to just ignore bankruptcies, ignore default rates on real estate and just focus on the positives? Or should investors be a bit more cautious now?
I think it's an issue of, are you talking about sort of systemically the overall economy or the overall stock market? I think the bankruptcies you're seeing and the commercial real estate issues are relatively narrowly focused in certain industries and certain companies, particularly some of the smaller companies, particularly those that had been heavily reliant on cheap financing, you know, a year or two ago, 3 years ago, when you had very low rates. A lot of companies could kind of make it through, even if with a weak business model, or ones that basically benefited from all the, you know, COVID-related stimulus and things like that, that no longer have that sort of tailwind anymore. And so, and commercial real estate, of course, being still influenced by not as many people back in the office and things like that. Structural shifts that happened kind of as a lagged result of COVID. I think that's where you're seeing a lot of these issues. I think they're not big enough to derail the overall economy or the overall stock market. Most of the big caps that drive the major indices and things are not exposed to those factors. They're not going to go bankrupt anytime soon, and generally are fairly stable, you know, financially. So I think it's some of the, you know, the smaller banks in some of the, you know, particular areas in California or wherever it might be that have exposure to those particular areas that are at risk and have been. And that's what we've seen in some of the, you know, smaller cap companies, whether it's small tech or small biotech or small banks that have focused exposure in those areas and don't have the capital raising capacity to kind of make up for it nowadays, that those have been at risk and still are, but they're not big enough or systemic enough to bring down kind of the overall economy. And then, of course, we saw in back in March and April that when Silicon Valley Bank and the banks then got into real trouble, the Fed did come in and the Treasury and the FDIC and everything, you know, they applied, you know, the deposit insurance to everybody for a little while and made sure that what was a localized problem for those banks didn't become a systemic problem. And of course, then they got sold off and things like that. So I think people are more confident that the regulators will step in the cases where it could become systemic, at least to the extent that they can. And they certainly did that with COVID to some degree as well. And so I think you're right. There has been a view that if things get really bad, the government will step in to do something about it. I don't think what we've seen so far is enough to generate that response or require that response. And I think it's more, you know, specific to certain industries and certain companies than to be a systemic thing. And also in general, if you look at things on kind of a rate of change basis, if they were really, really good in 22 or 23, earlier in 23, because of all the stimulus and recovery, they have to be worse now almost. They couldn't keep going at that rate. You kind of had a sudden drop off in 2020 and then a huge skyrocketing in the kind of the rate of change as everything reopened and the stimulus hit. And then you had a deceleration from that, you know, huge spike, which means that on a rate of change basis, everything is slowing down. And, you know, businesses that suddenly sprung into appearance during COVID or just after, some of those may have gone away now. But I think overall, the big companies and the big structural pieces of the economy are still relatively good. And you still got all that fiscal support flowing through into, you know, manufacturing, construction, technology, infrastructure, all that kind of stuff, which is helping balance out what otherwise would be headwinds.
Let's move on to commodities. You mentioned commodities back there a second ago in passing. I'm curious as to your view on the outlook for commodities, because there's been another full storm in the commodity space this year, and we've seen a lot of people expecting commodities to perform really well. And we'll set gold aside. We'll definitely talk about gold a little bit before we close. But what's your view on commodities both here and kind of heading into next year, given the potential for Fed easing?
I've heard from a lot of people, certainly earlier in the year, expecting more of a commodities kind of super cycle or a big trend, and that plays into the same view that inflation was going to stay high or go higher, 70s style trend. And my view all year has been that that's not likely to be the case. The drivers that caused that kind of things in the 70s are not here now. Actually, if you look at commodity price indexes, they really peaked in the middle of 2022, so 18 months ago, essentially, and have been mostly coming down since then. Oil has held up better than the others to some degree, partly because of OPEC and things like that, supply cuts and sanctions on Russia and that sort of thing. But generally speaking, demand for commodities has been weak. A lot of the things like industrial metals, copper and so forth, have been very weak. And I think part of that is because the supply chains have healed and the stimulus went away, or a lot of it, post-COVID stimulus. And so the demand for commodities isn't really there. And you've got the fact that China has been the swing factor for commodities globally for 20 or 30 years now. And really, it's basically lost that. We don't have China there demanding more and more commodities all the time. Obviously, they still use a lot of commodities, but their growth rate has really slowed down. I don't really see that coming back in a big, dramatic way, the way it has in the past. And so, and the fact that, you know, the world is kind of gradually shifting away from fossil fuels, oil, and so forth, means that the demand for oil and related fuels and things is gradually slowing. And there is plenty of oil around. You know, there's plenty of oil, there's plenty of gas, and it's just a matter of getting it to the right places at the right time. But it's there. Same thing with most of the other metals and a lot of commodities. And so when I look at the commodity price index charts, they look bearish to me. They look like they're in a downtrend, at best stable lately. And I don't see what the driver is going to be for a big, dramatic, broad-based resurgence, and which would have to come from either, you know, kind of a demand shock or a supply shock. I don't see the demand shock coming. I don't know where that would come from. Supply shocks could always happen. We could have another pandemic. We could have more wars. We could have things like that, which are very hard to predict. But some of that's already happened in Russia and in the Middle East, and we still can't get oil prices or commodity prices to go up. So in my mind, things that would normally have caused oil prices to go through the roof and other commodity prices to move happened, and then we still didn't go up, which tells you that there's still a lot of supply around. You know, they keep finding more metals and lithium and oil, and the U.S. is producing more oil than ever. Venezuela may be coming back online. There's a lot of other things that are going on outside of OPEC where they're struggling and trying to cut and trying to make the price go up, and they can't. I mean, it goes up for a little bit, and then goes back down again. So to me, that tells you that the dynamics now are much more sort of for headwinds for commodity prices and lack of demand. And so unless you get big supply shocks, which again, could happen, but you know, I can't predict that. And I think it's hard to build an investment thesis around that. I'm looking at more headwinds than tailwinds for commodity sectors. I've been underweight there for a while. I don't see, again, the demand. I've been underweight China for the same reason in terms of the equity markets in China and emerging markets in general for those reasons. So again, there may be pockets of areas that do better, but I really see commodities as kind of a headwind because I think global growth is going to be weak and I don't see the demand side being there for it.
Let's stick on China for a second, because I agree with you. I think the chance of Chinese growth coming back anywhere near the levels that the world became accustomed to is not going to happen. But of course, a big part of that growth was credit growth. And the abundant liquidity coming out of China was definitely a swell tide for risk assets all around the globe. So if China is slowing and if Chinese growth is not going to get back to anywhere near, that implies that credit growth in China is also going to kind of remain moribund. How does that impact the world, do you think, if Chinese credit growth is quiet and diminished?
Chinese growth will not ever go back to where it was. And yeah, I think a lot of it was driven by credit and sort of, you know, non-productive investment, where they pick a GDP number they want it to be, and then they just go out and build things to make that number happen, which is kind of, you know, reverse of what the rest of the world does. And now they're kind of finding the downside of that, at least at the state and local level, running into debt limits. A lot of the private companies, real estate developers, all those kind of places have borrowed as much as they can borrow. And a lot of them are defaulting now and then can't borrow anymore. And the state and local governments, I think, are going to have to be sort of bailed out in some way or restructured. And so that credit growth that drove a lot of the demand that China produced for themselves and for the rest of the world just can't be replicated again. And so if China is not borrowing as much, whether internally or globally, and not demanding as much in terms of, you know, commodities or and everything else, and still trying to maybe try and export their way out of it, you know, meaning focusing on exporting and manufacturing rather than domestic consumption, which they still are, it remains to be seen whether they'll really make a structural shift in that direction, which they probably should, but it's not clear if they will politically, means that there will be lower growth in China and, you know, the surrounding countries probably as well, and lower growth globally. That hurts demand for commodities, but it also, yeah, just means that you don't have that kind of capital demand, you know, as well. And that other, you know, non-Chinese companies and markets will be less inclined to rush into China to try to do business there as they were over the last, you know, 20 or 30 years, partly from politics. The government has not made it easy to do that, but also just the growth potential is not what it used to be, both from sort of the fact of, you know, the debt they've run up and the fact they have less capacity, and their demographics, of course, have really turned. Their working age population is shrinking. And so there's a demographic shift going on underneath all that that's negative for growth as well.
China's been such a big part of risk asset pricing for such a long time now, and its withdrawal from that as such a main factor. You know, my instinct is that you need something to replace that. I don't see where it's coming from, but I guess time will tell. But let's move on to currencies, because something else that's fascinated me is what's happening in Japan. And I keep trying to get different opinions on this, because to me, it's an incredibly important shift that could reverberate right across capital markets, but nothing seems to be happening just yet. So I'm curious as to your thoughts on two things. Firstly, the move by the Bank of Japan to normalize. And it's clear that that's the path they're on. They've got to be extremely careful how they do this, but it's clear what their desires are. And secondly, the yen, because the yen has been incredibly weak, and the actions by the Bank of Japan suggest to me that there's a very strong case to be made for the yen strengthening considerably in the months to come. But I would have thought the market would have sniffed that out. So, I could be extremely wrong. And I'm keep searching for someone to tell me definitively why I'm either right and early or completely wrong and a total fool. So maybe I can add your voice to that chorus.
Yeah, you're right. Japan has always been a sort of a special case economically for a long time now. But over the last few years, it's really stood out relative to other economies. And the fact that, the Bank of Japan has never really moved much off of its, basically zero interest rate policy in any really meaningful way. They've let the long end move up a little bit relative to where they had been in terms of the yield curve control. But essentially, they've kept rates, close to zero, while almost everywhere else in the world has raised rates, in some cases aggressively, like the U.S. and even in Europe. And so that's really made this much starker gap between Japan and everywhere else. And that's why you're getting the yen weakening so much. I think partly that reflects Japan is willing to let their currency depreciate because they are a sort of an exporting economy rather than try to defend their currency essentially and raise rates along with the rest of the world to keep their currency from weakening because they were afraid of what that would do to their domestic economy. I think the view from Japan is, I actually heard one of the Bank of Japan officials speak a few weeks ago, and it sounds like their concern is that the Japanese economy is still not strong enough to withstand substantially higher rates, and that the inflation pressures, whatever the inflation pressures they're seeing at the moment, are strictly because of imported oil and basically imported inflation and kind of temporary spikes in commodities and things, and that will go away. And that domestic, growth and inflation pressures are still pretty weak and therefore do not warrant higher rates domestically. Now, I think they would like to be able to get away from that. It would be nice if growth were strong enough to be able to raise rates above zero and at least be somewhat closer to the rest of the world and kind of be able to, have a little bit more stable currency. But I don't think that they view that as a realistic option at the moment. To be able to raise rates significantly and kind of normalize, let the currency, strengthen significantly. So, in my mind, it's the fact that Japan has always been kind of a slower growing economy for a while just because of demographics and everything else. But I think that they still feel that way, that they don't have the domestic real growth that they need to sustain higher rates. And therefore, they're just going to keep rates where they are roughly, or maybe let them creep up a little bit to not have to buy all the bonds in the bond market all the time, have let their currency kind of take the hit because they can kind of afford to do that being, an exporting economy, and that they're willing to deal with some imported inflation for a little while as long as they don't kind of crush their domestic economy. So that's kind of the way I view it. Their earnings locally, are showing up pretty strongly right now. So, and the Japanese stock market has held up well, again, in local currency terms. It's only for those of us who are not in, Japanese yen that have the offset from the currency. So they're kind of doing fine domestically from their standpoint, I think, and maybe aren't too worried about, the currency or kind of what non-Japanese investors think so far, at least, is the message that I've been getting.
The move from a mildly negative rate to a mildly positive rate, one would imagine wouldn't actually have too much of an effect, given how long they've had those rates at negative 10 basis points. If they move back to zero or even plus 10 basis points, it's not going to really affect things that much. But the message that sends is an extremely powerful one. We've seen the Bank of Japan make a couple of half-hearted interventions in the yen as it's gone through certain key levels. They've had immediate success followed by immediate repudiation by the markets, which is interesting and a reminder to everybody that central banks don't always get everything they want immediately. But it still feels to me as though ultimately a move towards mildly positive rates in Japan won't hurt the economy significantly and sends a message that could send an enormous wave of Japanese capital back home and might affect the yen. And with the yen at closer to 160 than 150 in recent weeks at various points in time, there's a long way that the yen can strengthen before it becomes problematic, one would think. There's an awful big snapback that could take place. And I just keep watching for signs that that's going to happen. And maybe I'm just waiting for Godot. I mean, it's been such a long time with Japan now. Who knows? But it strikes me as everything that Ueda-san's been saying, everything that I hear Kuroda-san has been saying after having left the post in private lunches and meetings, there seems to be a real determination on the part of the Bank of Japan to normalize, whatever that means. But I can't believe that normalcy involves negative interest rates.
raising rates 20 basis points, 50 basis points from slightly negative to slightly positive probably would not have a big impact on the overall Japanese economy. I don't think it's, you know, it's like a lot of things for a while here. Rates are not the problem. And so moving them around is not going to solve the problem. But you're right, there's a big messaging aspect to it. And because the you know, Bank of Japan has had this kind of policy for so long and defended it so strongly for years and years and years, yeah, it would be a big, you know, kind of political or, you know, kind of perception shift if they do that. And I think, yeah, I mean, maybe that they're worried just about the volatility it might cause in markets if they did suddenly walk in one day and say, you know what, guess what? We're getting off the zero rates. We're going to, you know, that would cause big, you know, shockwaves. And Bank of Japan, they tend not to like that in general, in particular. So I think what they're partly, you know, looking for is evidence that their underlying real growth rate has improved in some way. And that they can therefore say, okay, look, if the underlying real growth rate has improved and inflation is maybe running a little bit hotter than it used to, at least positive, you know, for a sustained period, then we can say, okay, that justifies us moving rates up a bit. I don't think they've seen enough convincing evidence of that, at least to make the public case that they can do that. I think, like I say, they've now been left behind by the rest of the world. The U.S. and Japan and everywhere else have moved the rates up much faster, much farther, and that's hurt the yen. I think they also maybe have the view that at some point, rates in the rest of the world will start to come back in again and narrow the gap at least somewhat, which will take at least a bit of pressure off of the yen. And that maybe has already started. We've seen the yen rally a little bit just in the last, you know, 2 weeks because bond yields in the US and Europe have come back down again in anticipation that, you know, this huge gap between the Japan and the rest of the world will narrow. But I think, you know, you're right. It's not the economic impact of a 50 basis point or quarter basis point hike in rates. It's the perception and the volatility that might be caused by that. And are you the Bank of Japan governor or the politician who wants to be the one to walk out and say that publicly? Again, I don't know the Japanese politics that well, but my perception is that none of them wants to be the one to stand up there and do that and be in the firing line unless they have really concrete evidence in the economic data that there's sustainably positive inflation and sustainably positive real growth that means that they should then adjust their sort of long-standing policy. So I think it's the public perception problem. The Fed has the same problem coming the other direction now, and that they're hesitant to make any dramatic moves in that environment.
Okay, terrific. I'm going to add that to my ever-expanding notebook on Japan and what the hell's going on there. Let's move on to gold, because we're having this conversation a couple of days after we had a very big but very short-lived breakout in the gold price through 2100. And everything we've spoken about, rates, Fed policy, declining inflation, it all kind of feeds back to the gold price. And so I'm curious as to your take on gold, what you think is going on and what you think is likely to happen into precious metals as we move into 2024.
Precious metals, gold, have kind of diverged from a lot of the other commodity prices. And of course, these being kind of the more financial sentiment-driven ones, they're not, you know, used for much, you know, in terms of industrial capacity and things like that. They're much more driven by perceptions of inflation and central bank policies. And generally what I've found is that there's a tendency for gold in particular to move with views on real interest rates in particular and the dollar. And so, you know, when you have a weaker dollar and falling real rates, that tends to be good for gold. When you have rising real rates and a stronger dollar, that tends to be negative for gold. And so I think the fact that, you know, bond yields have come down lately and you know, real yields have come down some, the dollar's weakened some, has been why you've seen this rally in gold from, you know, early October through just recently, the last month or two. I think the fact that gold has held up, even though real rates are actually quite high in the US at least, much less so in, say, in Europe or the rest of the world, where reported inflation is higher and rates are not quite as high as they are here. But from the US perspective, gold has held up relatively well. I think some of that is central banks wanting to diversify their assets and not be too dollar exposed, maybe, or to have some hedges in place in terms of their exposure. I think they've been buying some. And I think other people, yeah, maybe were expecting inflation to run away or to be more of a commodity cycle that would be led by gold. So I don't think there'll be a broad-based commodity cycle that will cause all commodities to rise. I think gold could do better if real rates do start to come down and the dollar is at least stable or weakened some. I think those would be tailwinds. I think they already have been. I think you kind of got a little bit overextended here just in the short run, and people ran into those price peaks from earlier this year and 2020, kind of acted as resistance lately. But going into next year, I think there is a possibility that gold can do better if real rates do come down. If we see tips yields and all those kind of things start to turn lower and the dollar weakens a bit, then that would tell me that, you know, gold might have, you know, further to run. That's usually what I've been, you know, looking at historically to see whether I want to be, you know, more exposed to gold or not. Now, you know, I'm not a gold market expert, but it has been behaving that way in terms of being basically negatively correlated with real rates and the dollar over the last year or so. So I'd expect that to probably continue. So if you feel like the Fed might cut rates, if real rates are going to, you know, kind of come down some, then I think you have a good argument for gold.
So with all that being said, let's talk about the areas of the market, the sectors that you're bullish on, the sectors that you're bearish on, and run us through kind of positioning if you can.
Certainly in terms of U.S. sectors, I still like kind of technology and technology-related areas. For most of those, the secular story is there. The earnings estimates are still much stronger there. And it's really just a valuation question.
Is this big tech or are we still stuck with Magnificent Seven or is there room to broaden out now, do you think?
Now, actually, in the U.S., I find that there is a broader scope, that some of the mid and small cap tech stocks, particularly in kind of the software and IT services and things like that, there's a lot of names in there that have strong earnings trends. And again, the valuation question is the trick with some of them, and you really got to buy them on dips kind of thing. But as far as big cap tech, they have had strong fundamentals. A lot of them have had much stronger earnings than the rest of the market. It's been a lot more mixed lately, though. You've had things like, you know, Apple has been relatively weaker in our work, whereas like NVIDIA has been very strong. You know, Meta has been pretty strong. It might be slowing a bit lately. Microsoft's kind of in the middle. So there's a lot of differences even among that kind of Magnificent Seven in terms of their fundamentals and even their relative performance over the last few months. They're all up a lot this year for the most part, but they've had different patterns. So, you know, in my mind, there is still a fundamental story there. Some people have confused the matter and thought that higher rates hurt big tech, and it doesn't. It hasn't historically over the last 20 years and hasn't this year and probably won't next year. They don't really need to borrow money for the most part. For stocks to have higher expected growth rates, the cost of capital, the discount rate moving around a little bit isn't the swing factor. So I don't think of big tech being exposed to the rates as a problem. Smaller caps can do to some degree, but even there, they're mostly equity financed and are much more focused on their growth rate than on the discount rate effectively. So like I say, it's more of a valuation question. If some of these have big runs and they get ahead of themselves, then yeah, you don't want to buy them there. Wait for a pullback and use those to buy as long as the fundamentals are still there. So there is a longer tail of tech that looks pretty good. Again, particularly in kind of the softer side, the hardware side, semiconductors and kind of electronic equipment, that's a much more mixed picture right now. They're much more cyclical. Some of them are exposed to China more or to Europe. European tech, which is a much smaller sector, but is much less strong than U.S. tech. Again, even outside of the Magnificent Seven, they don't have any really big tech companies there, but they're weaker. They just don't have the same underlying trends that I see in the U.S. Same thing in China. There's a few names that are doing well, but the average one is not doing that well. So there is a U.S. bias to that view in terms of tech, but it does extend beyond just the mega caps, in my view. So I think there's definitely an argument for staying exposed there, but then also looking at areas like financials have been improving in my work lately, banks and insurance and some of the financial services companies that can benefit from the higher rates and wider spreads that we're seeing. And then again, some of the industrials that have been strong all year that are tied to construction, manufacturing, engineering, you know, infrastructure, all that kind of thing, still have some tailwinds, I think, from the fiscal side that can benefit. So, and consumer is still okay. I think it'll probably slow a bit. And so you have to pick and choose, but it's holding up. And then the commodity space is where I'm finding least attractive, along with things like utilities that don't have the growth drivers and are exposed to disruptions from energy and from higher interest costs, things like that. Real estate is mixed. There are a few kind of signs of life, or at least signs that the worst might be over for some of the commercial real estate companies, REITs, but it's very kind of selective. And you have to be real willing to take a contrarian stance in some of those areas to buy some of the areas that are not exposed to downtown real estate, but that have other things going on. So I think you could pick and choose there. So yes, I think, you know, tech and financials are probably two of my favorite areas, along with industrials right now and selected consumer areas. I think consumer staples are probably a decent space for defensive exposure. Healthcare has been struggling. Utilities have been struggling. Real estate's been a struggle. And I think commodities are going to be a struggle as well going into next year.
Terrific. And just one last question for you, and that's the dollar. Now, what's your view on the dollar from here? Because obviously we've had an incredible run that has kind of come to a halt. And it's so funny to watch Twitter and all these places where as soon as there's a change in direction, everybody's out dancing up and down and proclaiming either the death of the dollar or the death of the death of the dollar. What's your view on the dollar currently, and with a view to everything we've talked about in terms of Fed policy, rates, going into 2024, what do you think the likely path is for that?
My interpretation is that, you know, a lot of this is still driven by rate differentials and or perceived, you know, future rate differentials. I think as the Fed starts to, you know, maybe look like, hey, they won't raise rates any further and may cut rates and narrow the gap between U.S. rates and the rest of the world, that will put some pressure on the dollar or at least remove some of that bid from a rate standpoint. You know, the dollar is also in some ways a risk-off currency. People get nervous about what's going on in Europe or elsewhere. They go to the dollar or the Swiss franc or some of the other safer currencies. And so if things get bumpy next year, you could see a bid for the dollar for that reason. If things are stable in terms of the economy next year and earnings are okay and everything else, and the rate differential narrows, I think you could see some pressure on the dollar. Now, that means, you know, off a few percent here and there, not a collapse. I think, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of people talking about the dollar in terms of its structural, you know, movements, and that, you know, that the dollar will no longer be the reserve currency, and I don't know whatever else the arguments are, but most of those I don't think have any real merit in the sense from the very basic standpoint of, if it's not the dollar, what is it? If you take your money out of the dollar, what are you going to put it into that you have more confidence in and that's big enough to handle it? I mean, the euro is the only second closest thing, and most people, I think, don't have enough confidence in the euro to make it the sort of dominant currency, given that there's no fiscal policy behind it, you know, coordinated fiscal policy and kind of a muddled central bank behind it. China's currency is never going to, or not anytime soon, is going to be able to replace the dollar. Nothing else is really big enough to handle it. They have the, you know, the capacity to be a reserve currency. So I think the dollar has, you know, maintained its sort of dominance through all the ups and downs we've seen in the last few years. I think it still will maintain that, barring some dramatic shock in the U.S. I think if there's the financial markets, the fiscal policy, the military, everything else, all supports the dollar being, you know, the place where people go to hold their money if they want it someplace safe. And that still is. So I don't think anything in the crypto area or, you know, digital currencies is going to replace it anytime soon. I don't see any of those big dramatic doom and gloom scenarios for the dollar playing out anytime soon. I think it could come under some pressure. I think that might be net a good thing. It's probably a little bit helpful for U.S. corporate earnings. You know, as long as it's not super volatile either way, you know, you don't want too strong or too weak a dollar, really. I think we, you know, we might get that. And that's what we've been getting lately. If the yen, you know, gets a little benefit from it, maybe that's better. So I don't see dramatic moves on the horizon unless you're predicting dramatic moves and from an interest rate policy standpoint. And again, unless we have a big recession or crash or something, I don't see that either.
Terrific. Sam, it's been a fantastic hour. Just before we close, just give everybody a heads up on where to find you, where to find out more about Mill Street and what you do, social media, all that kind of stuff.
Definitely the millstreetresearch.com website. You can find examples of the research. There's a blog there, lots of background and information there. And then on Twitter, yeah, it's at MillSTResearch, where I, you know, post relatively frequently. You can get examples of kind of the macro commentary, some of the industry and sector work, some of the stock selection work. Also on LinkedIn, there's a company page, Mill Street Research, you can follow, where I'll post commentary and interviews and things like that. So those are all good places to see kind of what, you know, what I've been thinking and examples of the work.
Terrific. Sam, it's been a real pleasure. I'm so glad we finally got to do this. Thanks for your patience, and let's do it again soon.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it, folks. My thanks to Sam Burns for joining me. Mill Street Research is the company. You'll find everything you need to know about Sam and the work they do there at MillSTResearch on Twitter. You will find Sam posting quite regularly thoughts, charts, all that kind of stuff on the markets, which is another valuable resource. So again, my thanks to Sam and my thanks to you for listening. I'll be back again with another guest in the not too distant future. I'll talk to you then. Bye-bye.
Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.